It's All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. After a one-week summer hiatus, we are back to review the week in North Carolina politics, plenty of finger-pointing, and a piecemeal budget process has commenced. Here to discuss are Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation, along with Rob Schofield from the progressive NC Policy Watch. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hey, guys.
Nearly 2 months into a budget impasse that is showing no signs of progress, state lawmakers have started what appears to be a series of smaller budgets. This piecemeal process almost feels like we're hitting the rewind button to about 4 months ago in terms of where things were in the legislative process. These mini budgets, this development, indicates Republicans still cannot override the governor's budget veto and that the governor and leading Republican lawmakers have made no movement in negotiations. Do you think this piecemeal approach is an improvement over where things were or just another step in poor governance? Rob?
I think the latter. I think it's actually been the plan all along for months and months. I think the Republicans have pretty much been planning on doing this. They've never really had any intention of seriously negotiating with Governor Cooper. I mean, really, if you go back to 2016, when Governor Cooper was first elected, there has been basically Republicans at the legislature have been in an attack mode toward him, toward his administration, personal attacks, refusal to really sit down like adults and negotiate this stuff. And this is just the latest exclamation point on that. So I presume this will continue for a while and we'll probably be here all fall.
Well, aside from the political stuff, and of course, you know, everyone's intrigued with that and the finger pointing and all that, there's a real philosophical difference, you know, with this budget. I mean, the governor has made clear that he wants Medicaid expansion as part of it. The General Assembly has said, we're not interested in Medicaid expansion. Let's talk about other ways to extend health care coverage to folks who are unable to afford it. So what we have is this impasse. And Jeff, you know, I don't know whether it's good governance, but and as a matter of fact, I think this piecemeal approach to budgeting, in a lot of ways, from my point of view, is preferable to putting everything in one huge document, hundreds of pages, kind of hard to go through. I like the idea of discussing some of these specific line items in the budget. I think it's more transparent. I think it's more accountable. You know, from that side of it, I think that is a good governance move as far as efficiency and getting all of this done. Because, you know, in a $24 billion budget, there's a lot of stuff in there. What they're addressing are high need, sort of immediate need, things that have wide appeal, you know, to go ahead and get those implemented. But it is a piecemeal budget. In the meantime, we've reverted back to last year's spending, which, you know, I don't think is necessarily a bad thing, but in the meantime, there's still other needs and other projects, other programs, other parts of that $24 billion budget spending that are not being put into place.
If you like it, would you have liked, do you like the timing of it now, right? I mean, it's the last day of August. They've been in for 8 months. If they're going to do this piecemeal thing, shouldn't they just have done it in March, April, May?
Well, no, because what they intended to do was to pass the budget. And, you know, as you recall, you know, I mean, we have these deadlines associated with the budgeting, with the fiscal year ending. And so in March, April, May, what the intent was to put a budget together that the governor would either sign or if he chose to veto it. I think it was clear from the beginning the General Assembly was not interested in putting Medicaid expansion in. I think from the very, very beginning, even before the beginning of the budgeting process, the governor had said that was going to have to be a key part of it. But I think the intent all along was to get a budget in place, have it passed and in place and implemented by the beginning of the fiscal year. When that didn't happen, then, you know, this is where we end up.
I heard them discussing this in February and March. I heard pundits discussing that this was the plan. I heard lawmakers discussing that this was a Republican plan. They knew that they were not, I mean, they knew what the deal was back then. They should have sat down with Governor Cooper and negotiated out a budget. It's just the latest tactic to try and sort of hold off this tide that they see coming. They're going to try and it's almost like a scorched earth policy. We're going to continue to just have it our way. We're going to, until we are voted out of office, we're going to totally control the budget process, and we're not going to sit down with Cooper and negotiate it.
But on the other end of that, Cooper also has really dug his heels in. So, you know, we really are at an impasse. Rob, his compromise was Medicaid expansion and another $500 million in spending. That is hardly a compromise.
We don't know, because they won't actually sit down and negotiate with
him. That's what he offered.
That's an offer in public, but when you sit down and negotiate, you have a give and take behind closed doors. That's what they've refused to do, and it's not just about Medicaid expansion. There are dozens of items. Education remains horrifically underfunded in the state. There are a whole litany of issues that Cooper identified, and they've refused to engage with
him. But the Medicaid expansion is the one thing that he has just been unwavering with. You know, he has said things like, you know, there's too many tax cuts for businesses, but yet he is giving away millions and millions and millions of dollars in targeted tax breaks for companies to entice them to come to North Carolina. So when it comes down to it, the only argument that really holds any sway is the Medicaid argument.
But a majority of Republicans in the House have already said they want it. So, I mean, let's
well, and that bill is set to go.
set to go for months, yeah.
Okay. A quick follow-up before we move on. Two quick follow-ups. One, have you moved at all on Medicaid? Is there any version of Medicaid, any slice of Medicaid? Is there any expansion of health care for people who are living in poverty or people with disabilities that you, Becky, would like to, that you would back at this point?
I think that there are a lot of options out there to make health care cost lower, to increase access to health care so that people can afford to buy the health insurance that they best fits their needs. As far as this Medicaid expansion, no. I mean, we've just seen this last week, this medical transformation bill that went through. Very controversial, you know, to put the current Medicaid program towards this managed care, this decision that was made. So our current Medicaid system, on which 20% of our population is dependent on for their health care, still has a long way to go to being shored up and to be a reliable, good program for those folks until we add another 634,000, most of whom are able-bodied, childless, working-age adults.
So thousands of people, more people will die this year as a result of that because we won't expand Medicaid. We know for a fact that thousands of people will die prematurely. That's the statistics that are confirmed across the country. And we know that hundreds of thousands of people who can't afford health insurance will continue to go to emergency rooms to get their health care. That's the reality of what's going to happen as a refusal of this, even to consider even the Republican version of Medicaid expansion, which passed 25-6 in a House Republican-controlled committee.
But in the meantime, because we've gotten stuck on this Medicaid expansion or nothing, there also has not been discussion of other ways to lower health care costs so that health insurance is more affordable for people. So we really are at this impasse with, you know, the governor dug in on Medicaid expansion or nothing.
We did have, I would just note for context, this health care association bill that passed in recent weeks. The governor let it become law without his signature last Friday. There's certainly division over that kind of policy. Some people believe that it's going to lower costs. Other people believe it might increase costs for other folks. There's not consensus over the price and or if it's going to improve care. But that is just one
That's
of those.
That's one example.
They have moved legislation this year, and I haven't agreed with all. But you can't say there hasn't been anything done on health care this year.
Well, one other quick, potentially a throwaway follow-up. As we talk about, everything grinds to a halt, or it seems as though everything grinds to a halt. And I can't help but think of Mitch McConnell, who has presided over the U.S. Senate for a number of years here. As the dynamics at play here, has it been like this before? As you go back a decade or two decades, is there any example of this? And I'm not pointing or blaming anyone mm-hmm. in particular. I guess I'm almost giving a tip of the cap to McConnell potentially as the one who has set forth this obstructionist approach to politics to some extent. Here's my question. Do you all think of Mitch McConnell as we look at the way things have kind of slowed down and the obstruction, the level of obstructionism that the legislature and the executive branch have with one another here? Again, potentially a throwaway question.
I think that there's no doubt that Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell are models for the Republicans who are leading the North Carolina General Assembly. You see it in their policies. You see it in the ratcheting up of the very intense language that's used to attack Governor Cooper and the Democrats. There's just been obviously we have big divides in our politics right now, but I think that Donald Trump is actually the role model for both Mitch McConnell and the folks that are running the General Assembly.
Jeff, I hadn't thought about the Mitch McConnell analogy until you mentioned, but I will tell you that, I mean, even here in the General Assembly, I was working at the General Assembly in 2001, 2003, in that part of the legislative history. And in that long session in 2001, we went until mid-December And things were really tied up with a group of Democrats. There were eight of them. They called themselves the Gang of Eight, that sided with Republicans in many of these same type of budget issues that were going through. And so it wasn't necessarily versus the governor, because at that time, I forget who the governor was, but it was it wasn't the party difference in that. But
easily,
it was,
but,
okay, yep, yeah, thank you. But there was that divide, you know, within the parties and a group forming together to really lock things up until they got their way. And it ended up being moderately successful. But, you know, this is nothing new. This has been going on for decades. I think the, you know, kind of the finger pointing and all, it's, you know, well, it's got to be Donald Trump. And, you know, this is terrible. This is the worst we've ever been. It's not. This has been going on for decades at the federal level, at the state level, across the country.
An observation from the youngin' here is that, not to make either of you feel old, but I do think that it doesn't shut off. I mean, I hear stories about lawmakers from across the aisle, staff members from across the aisle, you know, going out and having a drink or going out and getting dinner and being able to break at the end of the day. I think with social media, there is no break. It's a constant fight. It's a constant back and forth. And there's no time to step away from it. And I don't know whether that just makes it worse or more constant or just
I quite
different.
Agree. It's different.
I agree,
now.
Too.
I think it actually is very different right now. And I do. Although we have had divides in the past, we haven't had this sort of fundamental ideological divide on so many central issues. And we haven't had such an aggressively conservative legislature trying to take the state in a very, very different direction. They've been doing it for a long time. And now the voters have said, hey, slow down. We want to negotiate this stuff. And they're just not willing to slow down.
Well, the pull on the left is the other way as well. So you do. You have this divide and this identity politics. And one of the questions that I keep asking, you know, we've talked about the fight between the governor and the General Assembly, but there's also this fight or this tension, if you will, between the governor and the members of the Democratic caucus and the holding them to the party line. And, you know, I think that a lot of that identity, ideological politics comes into that. And one of the questions that I've been asking as this impasse continues to go on is, shouldn't the members of the General Assembly be looking to their districts and their constituents for what they believe is the best way to go and the best way to move the state forward rather than kowtowing to some kind of party lines?
Yeah, I think definitely. For instance, the Republican House that wants to vote for Medicaid expansion should be allowed to, if only the leader, the Republican leader of the House, would let them do it. I mean, it's a classic example of where the command is coming down from the top, and it's going against what I think the constituents want.
We could go round and round on this. I will move
and
on
usually
for
do.
Now. Meanwhile, a proposal that would return much of a state surplus to taxpayers is advancing through your legislature. As a reminder, the state has about a $900 million surplus presently. That is somewhat of a squishy number, as the budget and the big bottom line are unclear because we don't have a new budget. Regardless, under this proposal, individual filers would stand to get a $125 rebate check. Couples who filed jointly would receive $250 back from that state surplus. Becky, your colleague Mitch Kokai sat in that seat a couple of weeks ago and called this a gimmick. Is there any reason to think that this action would provide a boost to the economy?
I don't know that it provides a boost. I think it sends a message from the leadership in the General Assembly that they understand where the money comes from and have respect for the folks who are earning it and sending it in to Raleigh. You know, I don't know if it's a gimmick or not. You call it whatever you want to, and Mitch is my colleague, and he can certainly call it a gimmick.
But you would not.
I don't know whether it's a gimmick or not. I mean, I think it's a sign that this leadership respects respects where the tax money comes from. You know, there's worse things they could do with this money than return it to taxpayers. And I think you have to be careful when you get these kind of one-time, non-recurring monies as, you know, to what you can do. You certainly don't want to put that towards recurring expenses that may or may not occur. You know, the money may not be to fund those in following years. So you're kind of limited in what you might do with that money.
Seems inevitable to me that a major storm will hit North Carolina again, be it this fall
or next
fall.
We can count on it. Yes, count on it.
Or next week. Why not put the vast majority of that money in the rainy day fund?
Well, I mean, that's a thought too. Now, in this budget that's been held up, there is a lot of money that goes back into that rainy day fund. You know, I think the rainy day fund, when it's fully funded at that $2 billion that they're trying to get back to, and I think the funding in the budget that's being held up gets us just about back to that point. I agree with you. I mean, I think saving is a good idea. I think that's another option of what they could have done with the money.
Yeah, of course, there are desperate needs in just an array of critical services and structures that this money could go toward, and it would really be a drop in the bucket as to what the really need what the need really is. You know what this reminds me of? This really is what you would expect from a party that makes Donald Trump their standard bearer, because it really smacks of sort of like a tip. It sounds like what a casino owner would dish off to employees that are really poorly paid and they're not taken care of and their systems and structures aren't taken care of, but I'll throw them a tip. And that's what this feels like to me. And indeed, it's not even a tip that goes to everybody. It only goes to about 2/3 of taxpayers, because you have to have you're only qualified based on your income tax status. So there's a third of the taxpayers, mostly low income people, who won't even get it. It's just, I mean, it's another exclamation point on a dreadful session. It's a terrible policy suggestion, and I really hope it doesn't go anywhere.
Finally, justices at the state Supreme Court heard arguments this week about jury selection and racial bias in death penalty cases. Both of your organizations have advocated for some criminal justice reforms, some similar, some different. I'm wondering from each of you, your perspective, what you think the best ruling is that we could see from the high court here.
I mean, to me, it's clear that the Supreme Court needs to rule that these individuals were wrongfully placed back on death row. We're talking about individuals who got relief under the Racial Justice Act, had their sentences converted to life in prison without chance of parole. The legislature came in, repealed the Racial Justice Act, and then they were sent back to death row. There's also some other people who had their appeals pending at the time who were also seeking relief. I mean, to me, it's clear that those individuals need relief. It's a case of double jeopardy. There was blatant racism in their trials, and they need to, at a minimum, have this relief, and it needs to be yet another a nail in the coffin of the death penalty in this state.
Well, of course, it affects a very few number of people. I think it's, what, 6 or 7 individuals who were impacted by this,
directly,
who sort of got caught up in that, you know, the change from the law being enacted and then the law being repealed, and, you know, where do they sit in that? So it seems to me, and this is a legal question, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me that if you were granted the deal under one set of circumstances, then that ought to be the deal that you have. I don't know what the courts are going to do. I know there's a tremendous amount of attention on this, and as Rob mentioned, you know, one of the concerns from a lot of areas is that this is a runaround, a way to eliminate the death penalty in North Carolina. And there are concerns about that for people that believe strongly in the death penalty from those that don't. But, you know, the other question that I think it raises is, are the courts the appropriate place to make those kind of big policy decisions, or are those better made within the General Assembly? So I think there's a lot of questions that are going to arise from whatever the decision is. So whatever the decision is in this case, I think we're still going to be talking about what the ramifications are and, you know, where this ends up and consequences and, you know, what it might mean, particularly for the administration of the death penalty in North Carolina.
Yeah, I'll only add, if folks really want to understand what this is all about, Professor Mark Rabel, who's a law professor at Wake Forest University, wrote a column for us at NC Policy Watch this week in which he described the trial of his client in 2010 in Iredell County. And you would be shocked if you read what happened in that trial, what happened around that trial. You really would think you were in 1940s Mississippi instead of 21st century North Carolina. The blatant racism, it almost had this, it smacked of lynching fever in that town when this individual was convicted. And that's the kind of blatant racism that the Racial Justice Act was trying to remedy, and it's a tragedy that the law was repealed, and at a minimum, these individuals should get the relief they're asking for.
The last execution to take place in North Carolina was 13 years ago this month. Rob Schofield is director of NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is senior vice president at the John Locke Foundation. Enjoy your holiday weekend.
Thanks, you too.